My name is Sheila Broderick. In this programme, we invite people to share their funeral playlist and their thoughts about death, dying, ritual and the afterlife, if they believe in one. My guest today is Welsh artist, performer and organiser Stephen Donnelly, who was born in Brecon, Wales in 1984 to parents from Castlewellan and Belshaft in Northern Ireland. He says his work invites audiences to disrupt common conventions, to perform, explore and experience our surroundings in unexpected ways, offering opportunities to playfully reclaim the physical, theoretical and emotional spaces we inhabit every day. He regularly uses site-responsive performance in urban environments, using humour and honesty to re-examine the relationships between the personal and the social, inviting the audience to reimagine their surroundings and encourage social and personal criticism. These are practices he says he tries himself every day. Examples of his work are citywide improvisations, sending an audience on a mission to find secret locations and characters, discussing beliefs whilst performing as a UFO-obsessed street preacher, and disguising audiences as hen parties to see what they can get away with. His most recent work has fallen under the umbrella of How Do the Dead Live?, a series of interactive performances, happenings and residencies exploring the nature of grief and how and where we remember the dead. His artwork has been hosted at Elysium Gallery, Tactile Bosch, Chapter Arts, Bristol Old Vic, Forest Fringe Edinburgh, Fringe Arts Bath, Southbank Centre and Somerset House London. As an organiser, he set up Friends of the Palace Theatre, a group that campaigns for the restoration of a Grade II listed purpose-built Victorian music hall with the aspiration to see renewed public uses and facilities re-established there. He is also one of the directors of 2 Humphrey Street, a new community space in the centre of Swansea. Stephen, your most recent work, How Do the Dead Live?, sounds very interesting and intriguing. Can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Sure. How Do the Dead Live? Started off as a sort of a week, 10-day residency in Newport that was very graciously given to me by Tinshed Theatre Company as part of their R&D platform called Molecule, where I spent... So 10 days in a disused shop asking the people of Newport how and where do the dead live. I mean, I personally don't think there's another side, a place where, you know, the dead sit around in the clouds watching television or whatever they might do. I don't think they spend eternity knocking around graveyards. You know, they're lost, and when we stop breathing, my belief is that they're lost, but there are ways in which we find the spirits and energies of the people we miss, and this project was sort of the beginning of revisiting and reassessing rituals that I had, and also learning about other people's rituals from different religious backgrounds and faiths, just as a sort of a beginning to try and understand how, find a way we might sort of be able to converge on a way of understanding each other. I guess it sort of came from sort of a personal experience, like most decent things do, I guess, but... So all the things that you listed there, sort of, I wanted to sort of key into something a bit more deeper. And so I struggled with that for a while, and then I sort of I put myself into the centre of the work and sort of said, what do I want to discuss? And so first thing was the experience of my brother Paul passing away a couple of years ago, and just the feeling that the rituals that my family had adopted to keep his memory alive or to pay tribute to him, so weren't quite working for me, and that they were really important for the family to do. But on a personal level, I wanted to do something different. And I just wanted to ask that question to see whether other people had that feeling too. If I was going to keep a space open, just to try and bring something more meaningful and essential into it, I guess. And that's where it sort of began.
Where had you been remembering your brother that gave rise to this concern that it wasn't really true to his memory?
I guess every year my family do a little sort of pilgrimage to Clangenneth Beach. And Clangenneth Beach is a place that we spend a lot of time as kids. We used to go surfing there all the time when we were very young. And it's a place that has sort of a lot of resonances for all of us, really. So we'd go down every year, and we put flowers in the sea. And one year I went down and I just thought, you know, Paul never mentioned flowers as one of his favourite things. You know, this isn't really, you know, I can't see him sitting down the beach just waiting for us to bring him lilies every year. Do you know what I mean? Probably want surf and turf or something, or a beer, or you want something that was more for him. And I guess that's what started it happening. Just thinking, well, how could we sort of reinvent, or you know, how can we make this more meaningful, or how can we make it more fun? So on the back of sort of these feelings, I applied to Tin Shed Theatre. And I was able to run How Do the Dead Live from a disused shop in Newport. And then just got to sort of ask that question to Newport and spend 10 days having hundreds of cups of tea and coffee and talking about death with complete strangers. And it was really nice. I shouldn't, you know, some people would walk past and go, that's really morbid. And other people would walk in and go, I'll tell you about the dead. Put the kettle on. Like the first person who walked in was a clairvoyant. After 3 hours, I just felt really, really lonely. I was like, this person sees the dead everywhere and talks to them and has, you know, a proper relationship with them. You know, I'm walking down Clangenneth every year and my brother's not even there. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it was very intense couple of days, but it was very, very interesting. After talking to 3 hours with a clairvoyant, and then a group of born again Christians would walk in, and you'd have a big chat with them, and then a Muslim fella walked in, and then we had there's atheists, agnostics, and after a couple of hours, you're just like, we're all having the same conversations here.
We'll come back to the project, but for the moment, Stephen, what is your first track on your funeral playlist?
The first one I've chosen is Deathbed of Colcullen by the Pogues. It contains the line, they'll stick you in a box and they'll stick you in the ground and then you'll raise your head up and shout, let's have another round, which is, I think that's a good way to start a funeral.
McCormick and Richard Tauber are singing by the bed. There's a glass of punch below your feet and an angel at your head. There's devils on each side of you with bottles in their hand. You need one more drop of poison and you'll dream of foreign lands.
When you pissed yourself in Frankfurt and got sipped out in Cologne, and you're at the rattling death trains as you lay there all along. Frank Ryan bought your whiskey in a brothel in Madrid, and you text some fucking black shirt who was cursing all the yids. And a sick bit of Coop Cullen will kneel and say a prayer, but of course they're rattling at the door and the devil's in the chair. They used in tavern, you screamed it was your shell, but I wouldn't give you service, so you kicked the windows out. They took you out in Turner Street, kicked you in the brains, so you went back in through a bolted door and did it all again. And a sick bit of Coop Cullen will kneel and say a prayer, and the ghosts are rattling at the door and the devil's in the chair. Hey! Remember that foul evening when you heard the banshees howl? There was lazy, drunken bastards singing pity in the bell. They took you up to midnight mass and left you in the lurch, so you dropped a button in the plate and spewed up in the church. Now you sing a song of liberty for blacks and packs of jocks, and I'll take you from this dump you're in and stick you in a box. Then I'll take you to Cook Briar and shove you in the ground, where you stick your head back out and shout, we'll have another round. At the great son of Cook Cullen, we'll kneel around and cry, and God is in his heaven, and Billy's down by the bay.
So, Stephen, can you paint a picture for me of how you think your funeral is going to look, where it's going to be, who's going to be there, and what they're going to think of your song choices?
I've no idea who's going to be there, if anyone. I haven't picked a venue. It depends what's going to be open at the time. I guess, like, you know the way Shane McGowan was screaming then? I guess, you know, sort of when he goes, at the start of, or at the end of every chorus. I don't know, I think that's what a funeral should be. It should be, you know, instead of this sort of remorseful, sad thing. I know everyone's there because they are sad, and I think, guess this is where sort of How Do the Dead Live and sort of what it's trying to get towards sort of comes up and rubs up against sort of the reality of what is happening at a funeral or afterwards. It is sort of, you know, going to a funeral, having ritual, and all these things are really, really important to have, because at that time you are so sort of entrenched in grief that these things carry you along. But yeah, but I don't think that's any reason not to try and rearrange things or try and put more feeling in. I've been to so many funerals where, you know, you hear the priest or whoever sort of directing the funeral is talking about this person, and you're sitting there thinking, I don't know who that person is. Or, you know, you're reading that off a cue card. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. My funeral, right, yeah, I want Shane McGowan there, but he's not going to be there. I'd like people to turn up, really. At that point, I'm not going to really care, am I? I'm going to be beyond caring, that sort of thing. You'd hope people would turn up. But I guess there's more of a feeling that, you know, you'd want your last statement, if you had a chance to plan it, a last statement to be something unique. I think I watched a video online that was of someone's wedding, and it was an anarchic wedding. This is what the YouTube thing was called. Yeah, the two people who were getting married were going through their vows, and they directed everyone just to hurl abuse at them while they were doing it and throw things at them. And it was the funniest thing I've ever seen, do you know what I mean?
So you're suggesting an anarchic funeral for yourself, are you?
Maybe. I don't know. I guess I want it to be more like a wake.
In describing your funeral, you give the impression that you don't expect there to be an afterlife. But at the same time, the title of your project, How Do the Dead Live, gives a contrary view. So can you say a few words around that?
Yeah, I guess, like, for me, that the dead will live on through our memories of them and through our actions and the rituals that we perform for them. But I don't think, you know, personally, that there is an afterlife. The UFO sort of performance that I did, that you mentioned sort of in the intro, that was sort of an attempt by me to sort of, well, first of all, I was getting really, really fed up of being screamed at by street preachers in the street, getting really, really annoyed. Annoyed by their sort of ferocity and their anger, clearly anger that they'd sort of screamed that the end was nigh and that we were all sinners, everyone in the street was a sinner. But at the same time, there's part of me that really had a lot of respect for someone who believed enough in something that they would stand in the middle of the street and scream it. Despite the fact that a lot of other people probably just think that is in that case, and we're going to leave him alone. Yeah. So we've all got sort of images and sort of beliefs that we do hold dear, and I guess How Do the Dead Live does, that, you know, it has the word dead and live in it, which are two things that should be polar opposites. The answers that I got from it was able to get around. Pointing out one belief system. Yeah, because I guess they do live through us. Do you know what I mean? There is a continuation of people who've gone before us. Either if it's through their ideas, if it's through the mark they made on our lives, monuments in the street. You know, do they produce an interesting bit of architecture? Do you know what I mean? People live on through very different things, through their favourite meals, through...
Well, I suppose, and then you get into the whole idea of legacy. Some people will have a hard legacy, for example, in architecture. Other people will have a soft legacy in terms of maybe memory. And that's very unevenly distributed between people. So it's not clear, really, is it?
Soft. I haven't heard those two phrases in terms of legacy, and I really like them. A hard legacy and a soft legacy.
Yeah, well, I mean, hard as in, like, let's say, you know, built environment, you know, that's something.
Yeah, but I mean,
I
think it's nice, though. I really like it. Yeah. But when you talk, while you're saying that, that I had a gentleman walk through the door and started talking about how the dead live. And he, this gentleman, had done a lot of work with so the Romani Gypsy community, and told me about sort of a ritual that he was invited to, and it's very rare that sort of that community would invite him to this sort of family sending off, to sort of a funeral where they burnt all the possessions this person had, including where they lived, the sort of the caravan that they lived in. And it struck me at once as a very, very harsh sort of thing to do. But also it made me think of, you know, every time they see firelight, that person is alive again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
That
yeah.
person is alive again. And, you know, if you're in a community that has no fixed place, being able to produce fire is... that's life-giving, do you know what I mean? So, you know, and that sort of points towards memories and the dead as sort of a resource, a really, you know, an eternal resource is never going to not be dead people, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting the way that you're describing the way the fire holds the memory of the people who have died within that community. And no matter where they go, they don't need to return to a graveyard. They have it as part of their regular practice. Brings us along nicely into the next song, when there's a lyric from The Descendants, "When I Get Old."
Yeah, I mean, this song is more about, you know, people who are left, isn't it? Who are left to try and consider, oh, I'm going to be in that box, or I'm getting closer to that box, and what am I doing with it? And am I fossilized already? Am I already a fossil?
Was The Descendants, "When I Get Old."
Just that song, I find that song is quite a joyful song, I think. I think The Descendants are always a band that are about, you know, we're always very energetic and are always very honest and things. And that sort of, that song's a nice sort of a chance to reflect on, what have I done up to now? And is this a chance or a turning point to continue doing that? Or do I get to do something different? and I guess big life changes, like when someone, you know, passes away, is a chance to reflect, because, you know, your identity changes when that person leaves. That is a very scary thing. It's a completely unmarked territory, but even if it's painful, it's a chance for you to start to not reinvent yourself, but just to rediscover yourself as this new person, I guess. So if that is a song at my funeral, then that is maybe a chance for people to do that, to have a little bit of a reflection time. It's a very, very short song. They do very, very quick songs. We wouldn't have to think about that for too long. It's about a minute and a half long, I think. One of their quicker songs is about 5 seconds long, which is a good song about food. When people had a chance to write on the shopfront window in Newport, answering the question, how do the dead live? I'm just going to start reading these, and then when I remember, or when it comes back to me, there's the stories of them, I'll sort of elaborate. In a bubble clock in Cheltenham, this was a public fundraiser who I caught staring at the window. And the window sort of covered with bright pink and yellow and different colours, sort of scrawled chalk pen all over this sort of window. You know, it looked like someone had gone to town on it. It was very, I loved it. And so people had scrawled all over this, over this window, and this fundraiser had stopped and started looking at the window, and I sort of clocked her, went up and asked if she'd be willing to add something in answer to the question, and she sort of went, I don't know, really. I don't know. And then she'd walk away. And then later on that day, she came back and said a bubble clock in Cheltenham, and she was brought to Cheltenham, and she couldn't remember being brought to Cheltenham by her father years and years ago, and there was a bubble clock, this clock, and at 12 o'clock, these bubbles came out of it, seemingly in the centre of town, as I remember the story, and she only sort of remembered this clock while she was doing her fundraising job, and that she only remembered this clock ever existed, and when she was fundraising in Cheltenham and the clock struck 12 and all these bubbles sort of come out of it, and then she remembered that her dad lived in this bubble clock in Cheltenham, which was, I thought, was really nice. You know, you forget where the dead live sometimes. There was another girl, actually, who she was looking at the window. We had a really, really long conversation just about her life and my life, and it was a really nice conversation. She told me about her mum who'd passed away, but she didn't know where her mum lived. She couldn't remember like a place or a smell or something. There wasn't sort of a thing to anchor her to. And then I asked her about one of her tattoos, and she had a little like a teardrop tattoo by her eye, and she sort of went, well, I had that when my mum passed away. And I said, well, you know, do you mind me writing in our teardrop tattoos on the window, because that seems like where she lives, even if you see it every day and, you know, you forget what it's there for. So, yeah, that was another one that sort of struck me. You forget the importance of little things like that, you know? Things take on an extra significance. That sock, that holy sock, once they're gone, is this sort of, this holy relic, you know? Her passing away changes things when the anchor to these objects and these thoughts and feelings is no longer there. You know, there's no longer a through line. There's no longer sort of a cable for that energy to reach. There's no earth. There's no, you know, that earth cable is no longer there. What happens to that energy is really weird, which is why I think death is such a taboo thing. Do you know what I mean? I forget who said it, but someone said that tabooist subject, sex and death, are both horizontal mysteries, I think the phrase was.
Well, actually, it's very interesting. At a certain point in history, people used to sleep sitting up, because the view was that if you were lying down, death might creep up on you. A lot of beds at that time were very short, and then they'd sleep propped up. I have no idea how they had sex, however, so that's another programme.
Well, though, apparently people used to sleep. The sleeping patterns weren't the way they are now. Like, you wouldn't think you'd, you know, go to bed at 10, you get up at 6. You'd have a sleep and then you'd wake up in the middle of the night and do stuff. Do a bit of work, go next door, have a cup of tea, have sex with someone, and then you go back to sleep again. There was a different sleeping pattern. So maybe when beds got flat, that's when it all went wrong.
Let's go to your next choice. Amy and Elle, The Places, I think.
When I first sort of discovered The Places, I was on a bus on a coach, and I was going up to Bridgend, I think, because my girlfriend at the time was in an ABBA tribute band, and I think I was covering for one of the boys, so I had a wig on when I got there, and so pretended to play ABBA music on a keyboard. The Places were on a sort of a podcast, and as the song started playing, you know when you listen to something and everything sort of falls into place? The light was perfect, and the mood of the song worked wonderfully, and I was completely captured by it, The Places. It's a really, really lovely song, and it's sad. So this is an opportunity for people to cry, because crying's good. You shouldn't be ashamed of crying. It's a good thing.
Leaves upon this chestnut tree are making me so sorry, so sorry. 'Cause when they turn from green to gold, I'll know the summer love. September is but a half month, just time enough to sweetly wave goodbye to lives lived by golden hours on lovers' isles. Just time enough to set your course for a cold.
Was The Places with Gold to Green. Before we went into that song, Stephen, we were talking about the weighty topics of sex and death. The French call orgasm le petit mort. I know that there are some other people working on this.
There's one, I guess, le petit mortician. Or I don't know enough about to speak about eloquently, but her name's Clara Valentine. So she's on Twitter, and she's got sort of a series of things online. There's a good podcast there's a few podcasts that she's on talking about things. But yeah, she's worth checking out, I guess. But she makes things very accessible, and yeah, I'd check her out. Also, as well, if we're talking about artists who are working on death and grief and things, Ellie Harrison, who's based in Leeds, has been doing a project called The Grief Project, which is sort of several different types of performance and art pieces that sort of look at how we respond to death and grief in sort of playful, fun ways. But also she does one-woman shows in theatres and also sort of one-on-one performances with people. So she's worth checking out too. She's Ellie Harrison from Leeds. And yeah.
So in your own exploration of how the dead live, what kind of actions or events take place around remembering your own brother Paul?
Well, there's one that I haven't redone yet because his anniversary hasn't happened yet. But as part of Out of the Dead Live in Newport, I did a sort of a performance walk around Newport where I remembered the dead or attempted to make them live through different sort of performances and actions from one of my friend's mother, Rosie. Is remembered through her lipstick, so I chose a lipstick by its smell in a shopping centre, having a drink in a park. But I also delivered a surf and turf from a Wetherspoons to the River Usk and fed it to the River Usk. So eating meat sometimes for me is a chance to remember my brother, having a nice beer. So it was his birthday. God, I forgot that. It was his birthday the other day. Me and my dad went surfing to Llangennyth. We did, you know, we've completely forgotten it was his birthday. Really, really terrible at remembering dates. I always forgot my brother's birthday. I used to get just the number wrong. I think it's the 14th. It was last month anyway. But we went to Llangennyth anyway. We'd forgotten. And we did all the stuff that we used to do in Llangennyth with my brother, and then still forgetting. And then we were sitting down and I spotted a nice beer that wasn't like an ordinary beer, in like a craft beer sort of thing. And I just got this memory of Paul sitting with a banana bread beer. It wasn't like a beer snob or anything. He just thought, I'll try it out. And he was sitting there and he spent like an hour drinking it, just enjoying it and just performing an opinion. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, I did that the other day. I just sat with a beer and just, you know, experienced it. Instead of feeling sad, I just experienced the beer, and that's where Paul lived on that day.
I think it's quite a common thing to repeat the practices that you had with the person. So, for example, I know of a man whose wife died, and after she died, he went to the shop where she bought her perfume, and he bought up as much of that perfume as he could so that he could keep her smell around him for as long as he could. Those little things can mean a lot.
Mm. It'd be not, I guess one of the things with How Did They Live, what I wanted to try and do, didn't quite get there. Like there was a showing which was rough and ready, with an emphasis on the rough, but having some sort of South Wales version of Day of the Dead without stealing all that imagery, without just borrowing all this imagery. What would a South Wales Day of the Dead look, feel, taste like? And you know, it might taste like cheap lager, and it'll look like, you know, a hen do, and it'll be raucous and lots of energy, and instead of just having sugar skulls, because, you know, sugar skulls don't belong to South Wales, but there are other things that South Wales has which are unique to it that maybe we could put forward. And I guess that's one of the big things for me, is trying to sort of figure those things out.
Yeah, it's interesting because in many ways Halloween and the Day of the Dead have become so commercialised that they've almost become public festivals around selling things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But also, you know, it's sort of a sugar skull, sort of like tinsel, you know. Do you know what I mean? But it's just like, it is another decoration. But teardrop tattoos are really, you know, that struck me as such a unique way to remember someone. You know, not that everyone has to sit around and get massive tattoos or anything. What I'd like to do, because I know I brought a surf and turf to the River Usk, and that for me sort of spoke a lot about Paul And also sort of took the piss out of the way that we were remembering him, which I think that he would have a laugh at too. But I know if I was walking across that bridge with a Buddhist and an agnostic, and we all had to perform that together, we would have to have the discussion about, well, I don't eat meat. Oh, I'm against eating meat, and I don't think we should be feeding steak to seagulls, because seagulls did turn up, like hundreds of seagulls did turn up. What another thing I want to do with Out of the Dead Live is sort of bring performers from different sort of religious or philosophical backgrounds and actually, you know, get down into the how can we make a ritual together if there's six or seven of us, say, and how do we find this sort of almost perfect new surreal ritual, you know, between us, because I think maybe that's where, you know, this project for me needs to go. And I, you know, instead of just indulging a playful performance, to be challenged on it and also try to find that middle ground where we can make a new understanding of what it means to remember the dead that we can all sort of recognize in one way or another.
And that brings us nicely into your next musical choice, which is Down to the River to Pray by Alison Krauss. Will we take a listen?
Yeah.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, fathers, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, fathers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, mothers, let's go down, come on down, don't you wanna go down? Come on, mothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sinners, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sinners, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown? Good Lord, show me the way.
That was Down to the River to Pray with Alison Krauss. Stephen, displacing the rituals of religion is a tough ask. Where do you think we can go with this?
Well, we're all going to go to hell, Sheila, because no, yeah, that's right. It is difficult, isn't it? I think, and at no point am I saying these things or these rituals are outdated or we don't need them anymore. I think clearly that we're sort of not embroiled in them, but because they've come out of us, you know, it's so much part of sort of how we deal with major life events as a collective. Do you know what I mean? How we collectively acknowledge these things and get through them, and it gives us structure and everything. So yeah, so I've approached all this with that in mind. I guess that last song is explicitly religious as well, and I mean, I don't, you know, I have no qualms about religion. I'm not a believer myself, but you know, that song is a beautiful song, and it's come from somewhere beautiful. There's a quote here by Corey Taylor, who was an Australian writer, and Corey died on the 5th of July. But she, for a decade, lived with the certainty of her death, as she had sort of melanoma-related brain cancer. And towards the end of her life, invited a journalist to talk about sort of how, about her sort of diagnosis and her friends and family and her life. And she sort of made facing death sort of her project, and became fascinating to her, and she sort of shared that with other people. There's a quote from her, which is, "We're in a situation now, many of us, where we realise that secularism is good for so many things, but it has an awful weakness in that it doesn't prepare us in any way for these major events. So we lack ritual, we lack language, we lack any sort of poetry around the whole business. And I think we're left in a situation where we're just making stuff up. And whether it takes the place of these old rituals, I don't know. Probably not." And, I mean, I approached this project knowing that to a large extent, I mean, it is trying to make stuff up. But, I mean, I don't think it's a project that should be made or is made any less or weaker. Not just this, I mean, anyone who was trying to sort of look at ritual and explore it and reinvent it and repersonalize it for them, you know, it's the only reason we're here, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think as an artist, you're experimenting with different kind of forms, inviting people to try out new things, and you know, whether they stick or not is not something you've got a lot of control over, really. But you just got to keep trying.
Yeah.
And I think that's what your project does. You know, it kind of invites people in a kind of a comfortable way, where they can feel safe to experiment and to talk to you in a way that they mightn't talk to other people.
I think after talking to people, it was nice to realise that other people are in the same boat. And I guess I got that feeling both for myself and other people felt they were able to sort of go, yeah, this doesn't work for me either. There was, as part of the show in, I brought a surf and turf to the River Usk twice. Once was sort of the first go ever, which is a very emotional thing to do for me. And the second one was to try and, one, walk through the streets and look a bit daft for people. And secondly, was to start that discussion again. Hey, Steve, why have you got a surf and turf? And one of the group started talking about, I think they do every year in memory of their uncle, and Uncle Barry used to love this LP that they had. The LP was put onto a CD, and every year they have a dinner and they put the CD on and listen to the music. And one year, very recently, the CD started skipping, and so the whole sort of thing started grinding to a halt. And the girl who was telling me this story sort of went, we all sort of decided this isn't working. We need to do something else. Well, you wouldn't want us to be sitting here having the same meal, listening to the CD that is knackered, you know.
Well, it's interesting because for my own father, Morgan, when he passed away, one of our consolations was that my brother, Johnny, had a recording studio, recorded my father singing while my mother was playing the piano and singing very traditional Irish songs. And sometimes when we have family celebrations, the CD gets put in and we sing along with our dad. And it's a wonderful experience. And it's wonderful to hear his voice. So in a way, this idea of, you know, a digital memory actually works very well for lots of people. And I guess you can always recut the CD if you have the track on your computer. Mm-hmm. I think all of us are struggling to find ways to keep that memory alive and current in our lives. Will we take the next song?
Yeah, but you're saying something interesting about, like, digital memories as well, do you mean? Because, like, there's something about having, you know, an object of an object as opposed to a bit of information somewhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, why do we call them memory sticks?
What does your dad sing?
Now, come back, Paddy Riley, to Bally James Duff. Will we go to the next song?
Sure, yeah.
Your next choice is I'm Shipping Up to Boston by Drop Murphys. Why did you choose that for your funeral?
I guess thinking about people who have passed away, not only my brother, but my friend Jay, who passed away. And I think Jay and Paul would have got on really well. I think, like, Paul would have quite possibly idolised Jay, because Jay was like this sort of tattooed punk dude who was just this chaotic human being. He was great. But I seem to remember, and whether it's true or not at this point, I'm not that bothered, but I'm pretty sure that Dropkick Murphys were played at his funeral, and I'm pretty sure the Dropkick Murphys were played at Paul's funeral. Paul had a humanist funeral, so we chose all the songs and things, and I'm pretty sure one of their songs was included in the track listings for that. So I just thought it'd be good to be in good company, and I'd bung this one on as well. And it's sort of after Down to the River to Play is a bit more upbeat.
Yeah, it's much more anarchic than Down to the River to
sort
Play.
Sort of the pogey sort of thing. These are guys who basically, you know, they like punk music and they like the Pogues and Irish music. They're from Boston, so they're all Irish, right? So, they're good.
Also, good, the soundtrack for The Departed. So again,
it is, yeah, which is a great film. It's a great film.
Okay, let's have it.
Of my funeral, I haven't thought of the event. I've just sort of responded to the what songs would you have playing at your funeral, and a lot of them just aren't very calm songs. I guess just my favorite music's a bit aggressive, I think. Not that that is the most aggressive. There are some songs that I didn't put on because I thought they'd just be too much. either too aggressive or just too ridiculous. There was one sort of, I was sort of doing a bit of a plan in my head, and I thought of, you know, if I'm probably going to get cremated, so when the box sort of rolls off into the machine, there's either, you know, there needs to be either something very, you know, I don't want Dylan, what's his name, Bob Dylan's "Knock Knock Knocking on Heaven's Door." I don't want that playing. There's some other songs I'd like to play, but you know, I just don't think anyone listening would want to listen to them. It would be completely self-indulgent and, you know, mostly just random noises and just really banging beats and stuff. That would be completely for my benefit, but this isn't really about me. Your funeral isn't really about you, is it? Your funeral is about whoever's left knocking around and has got, you know, can get the afternoon off work. So, yeah, there's a lot of songs that I sort of didn't go into, I guess. But I think a lot of the songs are picked because I like them, and I guess I don't know, you'd like to be remembered, but yeah, wait and see about me.
Nghe tuyên có viên poet mọi sức ai đã bị ngài phép lại mang có viên vui vàng ca lon hát Kalon es kalon la, kalon la, and sound I on me. Take a hill, not a lily loss. Demon kalon la, nas cani, cani ti, the cani nos. Pedami. Then is he the seed? Call it Callan Landrin Weddell and doing birds, Alleluvies. Callan Lan and Sound Ioni. Take a hill, not Lily Gloss. Demon Callan Lan as Dani. Can it be? Bore fy'n ymmeniad Bwyd i'r nef a'r adain can Ar i ddew er mwyn fy ngeidwad Ros i mi galon lan Calon lan yn llawn daion i Tecach yw na'r lili glos Dim ond calon lan all gani Canu'r dydd a chanu'r nos Calon lan yn llawn daion i Tecach yw na'r lili glos Dim ond calon lan all gani Canu'r dydd a chanu'r nos.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of other versions of Calon. Like, it's a hymn. It's a Welsh hymn. And I don't, I'm not a Welsh speaker. But I had the words translated to me, and I just thought this is the most, it's such a beautiful sentiment. Do you know what I mean? And I'll read a bit of it. And I sort of practiced it this earlier on. I was listening to all these songs and got really teary when I read this. So I'm going to give it another go. And the words are, I don't ask for a luxurious life, the world's gold or its fine pearls. I ask for a happy heart, an honest heart, a pure heart. A pure heart full of goodness is fairer than the pretty lily. None but a pure heart can sing, sing in the day and sing in the night. And it's just a hymn that's asking for a pure heart. And I think, I don't know, that's a nice thing to aspire to, isn't it? I guess this song in my funeral is more of a sort of a little flag for me as a, you know, an aspiration at the moment. While we were sort of back and forth with emails and stuff, sort of and messages, and you made a mention of, oh well, you got plenty of time to change the track listing, and yeah, I guess this is something I'm gonna have to keep on coming back to. But yeah, for now, I think that, I mean, I, you know, it's a beautiful song, and I don't know whether I think Keris Matthews does it very well. There might be other versions of it, but this is a nice version.
So can you tell us what the future plans are for the How the Dead Live project?
Yes, there are lots and lots of plans. At the moment, there are still plans. There's another artist who wants to sort of work on remembering a project about remembering brothers in particular, and sort of putting together bespoke funerals for people to try and find sort of a perfect surrealist funeral. There's the projects that I'd like to do with people of artists of different faiths, trying to work out sort of mini rituals. So it's all sort of my time in Newport has just started a lot of balls rolling, so it's just about following them up. But yeah, I guess it's making sure there's enough time to process it too, because it was a lot of conversations, and yeah, there's things happening. So yeah, but it will happen in time, and that's okay.
And so your last piece of music, Streams of Whiskey by the Pogues.
All right, okay, yeah, Streams of Whiskey. I am going. Any which way the winds will be blowing. But yeah, I just like it. Again, I like it as a song. It's upbeat and it's got a bit of a jig to it. So yeah.
My guest this week was artist, performer and organiser Stephen Donnelly from Brecon in Wales, now living in Swansea. Stephen, thanks so much for giving us your time and telling us all about your project. If you'd like to find more about Stephen's art project, How Do the Dead Live, you can find more at his website, stdonnelly.wordpress.com. We are currently recording interviews for this series. If you have views you would like to share about death, dying, funerals, the afterlife, and would like to share your own funeral playlist, please get in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clonline Radio and the web at clonlineradio.com, where you can also find podcasts of previous shows. Thank you.
Thank you.